Good evening, I'm Judy Woodruff. On the NewsHour tonight, a difficult week begins. The death toll in the U.S. surges past 10,000 as President Trump pushes an unproven treatment and the nation's top health officials warn of terrible losses in the coming few days. We speak with two governors on the conditions in their states and how they're handling the fallout. Then Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson is moved to intensive care as his case of coronavirus worsens. And on the front lines, how hospitals are ensuring the safety of their workers, scouring the country for protective equipment and making their own when necessary. Plus, pregnant during the pandemic, as COVID-19 upends our healthcare system, women expecting to deliver confront an uncertain and dangerous situation.
My partner and I have dealt with some fertility problems and miscarriages. So what should be just like pure joy for us, it just has this added layer.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The COVID-19 pandemic has hit a new milestone in the United States, claiming more than 10,000 lives. And across the Atlantic, there is word that the Prime Minister of Britain, who has had the coronavirus, is now seriously ill. All of this comes as the peak may have arrived in parts of Europe, and as the worst U.S. hotspot may see a little light on the horizon. We begin with this report from John Yang.
In the main battleground of the U.S. war against the coronavirus, a possible glimmer of hope today. New York State reported a slight decline in deaths and hospitalizations over the weekend. But Governor Andrew Cuomo warned that the crisis is not over.
It doesn't really matter if we've hit the plateau or not, because you have to do the same thing. If we are plateauing, we are plateauing at a very high level, and there's tremendous stress on the healthcare system.
Governors in other states, now developing their own hotspots, say the worst for them is yet to come.
We are not close to the apex yet. We haven't hit that yet. And until we do, I think it's absolutely essential that we're continuing to be aggressive.
States like Michigan, New Jersey, California, and Louisiana are seeing cases skyrocket. They're among at least 43 states implementing some sort of stay-at-home order. The rest are still resisting. On Sunday, Dr. Anthony Fauci said they are putting themselves at risk.
Unfortunately, if you look at the projection of the curves, of the kinetics of the curves, we're going to continue to see an escalation. So we just buckle down, continue to mitigate, continue to do the physical separation, because we got to get through this week that's coming up, because it is going to be a bad week.
Surgeon General Jerome Adams compared the week ahead to other sobering moments in American history.
This is going to be our Pearl Harbor moment, our 9/11 moment, only it's not going to be localized. It's going to be happening all over the country. And I want America to understand that.
By contrast, last night, President Trump tried to project a tone of optimism.
We see light at the end of the tunnel.
The president used the briefing to again promote an anti-malarial drug called hydroxychloroquine and cut off reporters' attempts to get Fauci's judgment.
Then what is the medical evidence?
Yeah. Maybe 15 times. Okay. You don't have to ask.
He's your medical expert, correct?
He's answered that question 15 times.
While the drug has sped the recovery of some coronavirus patients, Fauci and other medical experts say the evidence is not conclusive. Trump economic advisor Peter Navarro has also been boosting the drug. Today on CNN, he defended his position.
Doctors disagree about things all the time. My qualifications in terms of looking at the science is that I'm a social scientist, I have a PhD, and I understand how to read statistical studies, whether it's in medicine, the law, economics, or whatever.
In London, a British government spokesman said Prime Minister Boris Johnson's move to intensive care came after his condition worsened over the course of the afternoon. He was hospitalized Sunday night with persistent coronavirus symptoms. In a rare televised address to the nation, Queen Elizabeth offered a message of hope.
We will be with our friends again. We will be with our families again. We will meet again.
She appealed for Britons to show good-humored resolve and obey guidelines that have shuttered businesses and canceled events, including this year's British Open golf tournament due to be played in July. Meanwhile, in Europe's hardest-hit nations, travel restrictions appear to be flattening the curve. French streets were mostly silent, despite sunny skies that lured Parisians outside. And in Italy, Pope Francis opened Holy Week on Sunday in a mostly empty St. Peter's Basilica. Elsewhere, priests said Palm Sunday Mass at a safe distance, from rooftops. This weekend, France, Italy, and Spain all had a drop in coronavirus deaths. But in Japan, where new cases are surging, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said today he would declare a state of emergency, shutting down much of the nation's densely populated urban areas for a month. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
Wall Street took hope today from signs that the pandemic may be easing in some places. Major indexes jumped more than 7%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 1,600 points to close at 22,680. The NASDAQ rose 540 points, and the S&P 500 added 175. And now for more on the news that the British Prime Minister has been moved to intensive care, I'm joined by special correspondent Ryan Chilcote from his home in London. So, Ryan, what is the latest?
Well, Boris Johnson, as we speak, is in intensive care. We learned just a couple of hours ago that he had been moved into intensive care. On March the 27th, he announced that he had tested positive for the coronavirus. He was then self-isolating at the Prime Minister's residence. That went on until Saturday, when we learned that he was still running government affairs. And on Sunday, we learned that he had been admitted to the hospital as a precautionary measure, we were told, for tests. It was at about 6 p.m. today that we learned that he had been moved from a regular unit inside the hospital into the intensive care unit. He, according to Sky News, was having trouble breathing and was given oxygen. And so there's been a quite precipitous decline in his health over the last 24 hours, Judy.
And we understand, Ryan, I guess there is reporting that he is not on a ventilator. Is that your understanding?
That's correct. He's not on a ventilator, at least that's the last we heard, and he is conscious. And before he was moved into the intensive care unit, he did have time to call the foreign secretary, Dominic Raab, and deputize him. Now, there's no formal process, handing over of power in this country, but the foreign secretary is effectively now the number two. Boris Johnson has asked him to run the government's affairs, run the government's meetings in his absence. And that, he says, is exactly what he is going to do until Boris Johnson gets better.
All right. Ryan Chilcote reporting from London. And we should add that President Trump at his briefing taking place right now at the White House has said that he has offered a U.S. medical specialist to be of help to the prime minister if they could be helpful in any way. Ryan, thank you. We now have the first national snapshot of what hospitals are facing around the country as this emergency escalates. A new survey from the Inspector General's Office at the Department of Health and Human Services surveyed more than 320 hospitals during the week of March 23rd. It found hospitals needing to train other staff to help patients on ventilators. The survey showed many hospitals waiting 7 days or more to get test results, and some didn't even have enough basic cleaning supplies in stock. Ann Maxwell oversaw this as the Assistant Inspector General for Evaluation and Inspections, and she joins me now. Ann Maxwell, thank you very much for talking with us. Not even enough cleaning supplies. Is this as bad as it sounds?
We heard of a number of challenges across the country from the hospitals we spoke to, and you're right. We saw challenges in terms of a lack of PPE, cleaning supplies, thermometers, toilet paper, food, indeed.
And how could this be? I think people are looking at this and thinking, yes, this coronavirus has come upon us quickly, but How surprising was it to you, as somebody who works for the Department of Health and Human Services, that hospitals would be so short-handed?
What we found is the emergence of COVID-19 is really creating unprecedented challenges for the hospitals around this country. And we focused on, for this report, what were the challenges they faced so that we could make sure their voices and their experiences were part of the decision-making and support that was coming from all levels of federal government, state government, and local government.
One of the main findings I see was that the difficulty with testing, having enough of the testing, getting the results back quickly enough. What did you find in that regard?
That's a particularly interesting challenge because it demonstrates one of the interesting aspects of this report. By looking at a snapshot in time, we were able to look at all of the challenges, not only as individual challenges, but how they intersect with each other and actually exacerbate each other to create greater stress and challenge for the hospital. So with respect to testing, we found that hospitals were telling us it would take about 7 days to get the test back. And in that time, that patient had to be treated as a positive case. So that patient was taking up a bed in an isolation unit, they had to use PPE, and even affected staffing. So this one challenge had a domino effect, creating other challenges throughout the hospital.
And one of the other findings I think was so disturbing, it said one hospital had received two shipments from the Federal Emergency Management Agency with protective gear that had expired 10 years ago. Another hospital got 1,000 masks from federal and state governments, and half of the masks were for children and thus not usable for adults. And finally, there were some masks that were dry rotted. Again, I mean, how could it be?
Yeah, hospitals expressed a lot of challenges and uncertainty about getting restocking their supplies that they need so desperately. And as you mentioned, there were concerns about both the quantity and the quality of supplies coming in from both federal and state stockpiles.
And what does this add up to? I mean, does this mean that hospitals are literally not able to do the job we asked them to do?
One of the things that we talked about with the hospitals was not only the challenges that they faced, but also the solutions they were putting in place to mitigate these challenges. And it was incredibly amazing to see what they were doing to mitigate these challenges, the ingenuity and the drive they were exhibiting in trying to address some of these challenges. Even with that, though, they saw pressing needs for additional government assistance to support them in this unprecedented time.
Whose responsibility is it, Ms. Maxwell, that this has fallen, that the system has fallen to this level?
We were looking at this holistically, and to be clear, our focus was really to get some insight experience from the hospitals to help the decision-making. We understand that very consequential decisions are being made right now, and we wanted to focus on ways that we could help. We know that good information from hospitals can lead to good decision-making, and that was really the focus of our study.
So does this mean now that not just the hospitals, but state and local and even federal officials are now able to look at this and do something about it?
That is the whole point of this project, to take a snapshot in time that's nationally representative of hospitals around this country and be able to deliver that information to the key decision makers at local, state, tribal, and federal levels so they are armed with the information they need to make good decisions to help all of us in this time of quite trying time.
And how confident are you that the people who need to see this are going to see it?
That's a great question. And one of the reasons we did this is because we realized that as the Office of Inspector General, as an independent oversight body, we had a unique role. We could take this information and give it a platform and deliver it directly to the leadership of HHS, directly to the congressional committees and others throughout the federal government. So we offer this in ways to help them make those decisions.
Ann Maxwell is the Assistant Inspector General for the Department of Health and Human Services. We thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your interest in this work.
Governor Andy Beshear of Kentucky is one of the many leaders across the country competing with the federal government and with other states to secure critical medical equipment needed by hospitals in his state. Governor Beshear joins us now from Frankfort. Governor, thank you so much for talking with us. Give us an update. I believe Kentucky is a state with a population of, what, 4.4 million people. Give us an overall update on how you are handling coronavirus at this point.
Well, thank you for having me. And let me start the way I start every time I talk to Kentuckians every day at 5. And that's saying that we will get through this and we will get through it together. Battling this coronavirus is our patriotic duty as Kentuckians and as Americans. And I could not be prouder of how Kentuckians have banded together to address this coronavirus. We address it in three ways right now. Number one is using social distancing to make sure that we can flatten our curve. And I believe that our people have bought in and are actively doing that. I couldn't be prouder of them. We've had to change our way of life. We have had to close hundreds, thousands of small businesses. We have people not going to work that otherwise would have, but they understand that sacrifice is going to save lives. Second is we work every day to increase our healthcare capacity, to make sure when we have our surge hit, that we have a bed for those that need it, and that we have a ventilator for those that need it. And third, we work on increasing our testing as a state. That is a challenge all across the country. Right now, the major issue is having enough swabs. It's not our testing capacity. Now, number two and three there are limited by personal protective equipment. And I, like every other governor, are out there trying to scratch and claw to buy as much as we can. I don't place blame in any of that. And none of us knew about this specific virus 4 months ago. But it is a difficult system where our people on the front lines don't have what they need. But if I can really quickly, it just makes what they are doing more heroic. Doctors, nurses, and others in my state go to work every single day knowing that their coworkers have contracted the coronavirus and that they don't have enough personal protective equipment. And that just makes their sacrifice and their willingness to do it that much more amazing. This is National Public Health Week, and Governor, we greatly appreciate them.
Governor, you said over the weekend that every order for personal protective equipment had been, in your words, circumvented by the federal government. So are you getting what you need now?
We are not getting nearly what we need on personal protective equipment. And that's not just me, and I'm not feeling sorry for myself or for Kentucky. That's everybody. One of two things will happen. Either an order that we believe is coming in will be diverted by the federal government, by FEMA, and sent to a place that needs it. I know we need it, and there are other places that need it too, many of which have a spike in cases right now, and my heart goes out to them in New York or New Orleans. But the other thing that will happen is those you've contracted with We'll call you right at the end and say, well, we don't have it, or it went to another place. Buying personal protective equipment right now is one of the most difficult things that any of us have ever had to do through government, and we are reaching out through every possible lead. That's what I do in large part of my day every day, try to chase down these leads.
So my question is the current system that requires governors to compete the way you are, the best way to have done this? Should have this have been something where it was allocated in one central place?
Oh, I mean, a system where governors are competing against each other is a bad system. But again, I try not to place blame because we didn't know that we would need this much personal protective equipment as a world, not just as a country, until the coronavirus truly hit. I hope that we don't just learn our lessons, but that we can increase our capacity and we can have a better way to get this out where it's needed as we move forward. It is tough to say as a state you should go out and get it on your own and then have to compete with the federal government, but we're just doing what everybody else is. But let me mention two other ways that we get it, both of which are important. We're working with our local businesses to try to manufacture it. And we've got a company that changed their leather making into a face shield manufacturing, which has been really significant and helpful. And we're working with others to try to create masks and gowns and the other forms of PPE. But let me say that the third way we do it is donations. And we have seen everything from our veterinarians to our large industrial manufacturers step up and provide us hundreds of thousands of pieces of PPE that are going directly to our healthcare providers.
Governor,
what happens when we unify as a state?
Governor, very quickly, you obviously have had a stay-at-home order in Kentucky. Two states, not your neighboring states, but they're close. They are Arkansas and then South Carolina, which is a couple of states away, but still in the region where you are, do not have stay-at-home orders. Does that affect the ability of people in Kentucky to stay healthy, to stay safe?
Well, in Kentucky, we have taken aggressive action. And what that means is we don't just issue what we call a healthy-at-home order, but it means we've had to shut businesses. We have our houses of worship doing virtual services, tens of thousands of people not going to work. We have made sacrifices. And this coronavirus doesn't know boundaries, state boundaries or county boundaries. And when others don't take aggressive action, what they do is at least thwart the sacrifice of millions of Kentuckians and residents of other states that are doing what it takes to defeat this virus. And so I wouldn't ask another governor to look at me and explain it. I would ask them to look at my people who aren't going to work, who's shut down a small business that was their dream because they want to protect each other. This is a test of our humanity, whether we will put each other's lives ahead of our own economic self-interest. I know we're passing it here in Kentucky. We need to pass it as a country.
Governor Andy Beshear, thank you very much for talking with us, and we wish you and the people of Kentucky the very best in all this.
Thank you.
In the day's other news, President Trump discussed the pandemic with former Vice President Joe Biden, his prospective Democratic opponent this fall. The president confirmed it and said he appreciated the conversation. Both sides said it was a good call. In recent days, former Vice President Biden had criticized Mr. Trump for moving too slowly. Wisconsin is now going ahead with its presidential primary tomorrow. Democratic Governor Tony Evers had ordered today that the vote be delayed until June. He cited the pandemic. But Republican legislative leaders appealed, and very late today, the state Supreme Court ruled that the primary must take place as scheduled. The ousted Inspector General for the U.S. intelligence community is urging other federal agency watchdogs to not allow themselves to be muzzled. President Trump fired Michael Atkinson Friday night for passing on a whistleblower's complaint that led to Mr. Trump's impeachment. In a statement overnight, Atkinson appealed to other inspectors general, saying, quote, please do not allow recent events to silence your voices. The U.S. State Department today designated a Russian white supremacist group as a terrorist organization. Officials said that the Russian Imperial Movement has given paramilitary training to neo-Nazis and other white supremacists in Russia and elsewhere.
These designations are unprecedented. This is the first time the United States has ever designated white supremacist terrorists, illustrating how seriously this administration takes the threat.
The Trump administration has been criticized for not taking the white supremacist threat seriously. In Ukraine, a forest fire is still burning near the ruined Chernobyl nuclear plant. Officials say the fire has released radiation well over normal levels. But in Kiev, 60 miles south, radiation is within norms. The fire erupted over the weekend in the contamination zone. The area was sealed off after the 1986 explosion that destroyed the plant. Some passings in the sports world tonight. Baseball legend Al Kaline died today at his home in Michigan. There was no word on the cause. The Hall of Famer played his entire 22-year career with the Detroit Tigers and came to be known as Mr. Tiger. Al Kaline was 85 years old. Pro Football Hall of Famer Bobby Mitchell died Sunday at 84. The cause of death was not released. Mitchell was the first black member of the Washington Redskins. He also played for the Cleveland Browns. And Tom Dempsey died Saturday of complications from COVID-19. In 1970, with the New Orleans Saints, he kicked a record field goal, 63 yards, despite having no toes on his kicking foot. Tom Dempsey was 73 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, childbirth and COVID-19, the unfamiliar challenges faced by pregnant women, how the countries of the Middle East are weathering the threat of coronavirus, plus Amy Walter and Tamara Keith on politics at a moment of crisis.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Now we look at how the coronavirus outbreak is affecting soon-to-be mothers. Nearly a million women in the U.S. are expected to give birth in the next 3 months. With health resources stretched thin and changing guidelines, many pregnant women around the country are finding themselves increasingly on edge. Amna Nawaz has this report.
Deborah Barrick is due tomorrow. She and her partner live in New York, now the U.S. epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak. After several years of trying to conceive, this will be their first child.
It's been a struggle just to get to this point. My partner and I have dealt with some, fertility problems and miscarriages. So what should be just like pure joy for us, it just has this added layer.
Across the country, expectant mothers and those who've recently given birth are grappling with this new normal.
The pandemic has changed my pregnancy.
It made everything a little bit more complicated.
It's just going to be us.
Healthcare providers have had to rethink how to best deliver prenatal care in the middle of a global pandemic. For routine visits, many doctors are limiting in-person appointments, instead relying on telemedicine. During delivery, several hospitals have restricted or eliminated any visitors, including partners in some cases.
It's completely empty.
Outside Chicago, Hannah Beltry recently gave birth to her daughter, Paula. This delivery, she says, was a world away from her first.
And this time around, going into labor with just like three nurses at the nurse's station and nobody walking the hallways, like you didn't see any other moms, you didn't see any other dads. It was really just a very surreal, creepy situation.
Even harder, she says, is celebrating a new life while thousands around the world are mourning.
You want to look back on these moments in your life and be happy about it and excited because you just brought this new human into the world and they're beautiful. And all I'm going to think about is the fact that all these people were dying.
For Alexandria Jordan, a physician's assistant in Cleveland, Ohio, the stress lies in the uncertainty. She's due on July 4th, continues to work in a hospital, and is worried for her own health and the baby's.
I had this moment of severe anxiety where I just was so scared that I was going to get this disease from work.
A phone call with her OB calmed her for the moment, but a call with him the next day made her even more anxious.
And he goes, just so you know, I'm actually being in the emergency room being tested for coronavirus right now. I said, what? There's my stress level going up.
I am enough.
In Alpharetta, Georgia, just north of Atlanta, Janice Jackson and her husband John will be caring for three children when their baby arrives in June. As with their older children, they'd planned to rely on family traveling in from out of state to help. Now, they don't know how they'll manage.
Who do you turn to when you have no one? You know, is there a possibility that I'm going to have to give childbirth by myself because my husband's going to have to be home with my two older children? And that's a scary thought, just thinking about it, because you need a lot of support after you give birth.
Another unknown, the effects of COVID-19 on pregnant women and their babies, including if the virus can pass from mother to child. Dr. Shirsi Agard is professor of maternal fetal medicine and obstetrics and gynecology at Baylor College of Medicine and Texas Children's Hospital.
So what we don't yet know is what is the disproportionate risk for women of either requiring intensive care units? Is it going to occur while they're pregnant, just after they deliver? What is the risk of death among pregnant women? We don't know that.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, says pregnant women might be more susceptible to viral respiratory infections, including COVID-19. A World Health Organization study of nearly 150 pregnant women in China found they do not appear to be at higher risk of severe disease. But Dr. Agard says caution is key.
I think that women understand that those decisions are never made lightly. They're made with the acknowledgement, again, that we just don't know yet some of the key aspects of this virus, and we have to err on the side of how can we be most safe with a mom and her baby.
But for some women, Black women in particular, a safe childbirth was a concern even pre-pandemic.
What we know about maternal mortality, in particular with African-American women, it crosses all socioeconomic strata.
Dr. Tolly Elliott is an OBGYN and chief medical officer of Mary Center, a community health organization in Washington, D.C. He worries that a health system already biased against women of color could fail them even worse under the strain of a pandemic.
When the health resources are at stressed at a maximum, it really does become a problem because now you have a lot of people trying to get to a finite number of resources. The rest of the world does not stop. Clinical things still happen, heart attacks still occur, babies are still being born, and women still need our help.
For some of these women, there is solace in the fact that they're not alone.
There are just so many people going through this exact same experience right now. And it sucks. But I think mothers are strong. And this moment will be over at some point.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Amna Nawaz.
A little more than 10 weeks ago, Illinois' Governor J.B. Pritzker announced a woman in Chicago was diagnosed with the coronavirus, the second known case in the country. Today, the number of known cases in Illinois has surpassed 12,000, and more than 300 people have died. Here with me now is Governor Pritzker, who joins us from Chicago. Governor, thank you very much for being with us. Illinois' 12-plus million people. How are you doing in grappling with COVID-19?
Well, thank you for asking. Unfortunately, we have about 11,000 cases that have been detected in our state. We've had just over 300 deaths so far. We are tracking very closely the hospitalizations and the ICU beds and vents that are being used. They're not being overutilized at the moment, and we've been working hard to expand our capacity so that we would be ready in the event that we are peaking in the next couple of weeks, which I think we all expect.
And I wanted to ask you about that. Chicago's been described, of course, the big city of Chicago, as one of the hot spots in the country. What do you expect in terms of the trajectory of when this is going to get, you know, as bad as it can get?
Well, there are a number of models that we look at because none of them is exact in any way. But it does look like somewhere between the middle of April and the end of April, we'll see a peak. We have built out 500 beds already in our McCormick Place Convention Center in downtown Chicago so that we can have COVID patients in there. We're adding 2,500 new beds on top of those 500 at McCormick Place, and we're going to have most of that done by this Thursday. So thanks to the Army Corps of Engineers and FEMA, we've been able to get that done in, I mean, almost no time. They're really amazing.
You've been very direct in terms of talking to the people of Illinois about the supplies that you need, the personnel that you need. Where does that stand right now?
Well, unfortunately, the federal government really has delivered less than 10% of what we've asked for. in terms of PPE and other equipment. We need much more than they've delivered to us. So we've gone out onto the global market. I've got an entire team of people within my emergency management department, my Department of Public Health, and my governor's office who have become supply chain experts, buying PPE wherever we can find them, ventilators, which are so hard to come by and very expensive. We're bidding, unfortunately, for all of these items of equipment against the federal government and against the other states and against other countries, because what the White House has done is created, you know, they call this the air bridge, where they're bringing stuff back from China to the United States, and then they're delivering it to private companies in the United States, not to the states. And they're letting all of us bid against each other for those goods that are owned by the private companies. So we've just gone around all that and gone directly to manufacturers wherever we could so that we can fulfill our needs. We have healthcare workers and frontline first responders who desperately need the PPE, the masks and gowns and everything else that we're ordering. And we're doing a pretty good job, I think, so far of supplying that. But, you know, it's hard to look beyond 10 days or to have enough supply beyond 10 days. And so we worry every single day that we're going to have enough.
And that's what I want to ask you about, because you've talked about not getting what you need from the federal government. Today, President Trump said of you, he said he's a very happy man, but this is one day after what he said yesterday, which is that you're somebody who, in his words, is complaining all the time, hasn't performed well. He said the governor couldn't do his job in Illinois, so we had to help him. How are you, how have you responded to that?
Well, we governors have done far more than the president of the United States has to fight coronavirus. And here in Illinois, look, he's calling me a happy man today. The fact is that, look, I'm happy when I get the things that are required to save the lives of the people of Illinois. And I'm upset with the federal government when they don't deliver on their promises. They promised that they were going to bring tests to the state of Illinois. They've done very little of that. When they stood up in front of a podium, they said, oh, we've delivered millions of tests across the United States. They have not. They've also promised PPE, and they've said they're delivering it to everybody. A small fraction of what's been promised. I don't like people who make promises and don't deliver, so I'm delivering for the people of Illinois by making sure that we're acquiring what we need. I'm doing everything that I can. I hate the idea that I'm competing against other people in the United States, other governors even, to try to get what we need. But this is what President Trump has done to the country.
Do you think your dispute with the president has in any way hindered your ability to get what you need from the federal government?
No, and I want to credit the president and I want to credit the military. He has assigned the military to help us out, the Army Corps of Engineers, which has gone to New York, it's gone to California, and it's come here to Chicago. They helped us build out McCormick Place. I mean, our great tradesmen here in Illinois are the ones who, with the hammers and nails, but it was the Army Corps of Engineers that led that effort. So I am truly, truly grateful to them. I'm grateful to those who helped us stand up some of our drive-through testing facilities. But so my problem is not with them. My problem is with the leadership at the top, the people who are making the decisions. Remember, this all came very late. They knew, now we know, the president knew in January that the pandemic was on its way and did nothing. And even as late as early March was saying this is a hoax of some sort, or it's like the flu, it'll just pass over. He knew better. Or at least the people around him knew better. And yet here we are, you know, late start, only about a week or so ago, invoking the Defense Production Act just for one company. That was for GM. He's now invoked it two companies, and he's not actually telling them what to do with it. He's just saying, we need you to produce these things. What you do with them is up to you. So this is a problem. I'm a businessman before I became right. governor. I understand the idea of a competitive market, but not in a national emergency.
Just in a few seconds, Governor Pritzker, neighboring state of Iowa has not asked people to stay at home. Does that affect Illinois?
Yes, but the blame falls squarely on the White House for this. Had they said early on that it's time for everybody to put a stay-at-home order in place, the governor of Iowa, the governor of Missouri, all the Republican governors that were late in putting in their stay-at-home would have done it. But look, that's where we are. I know that the governor of Iowa is trying very hard without issuing a stay at home to nevertheless have a number of non-essential businesses close and have the schools closed and so on. So, look, everybody's approached this differently. It does make it more difficult for states like mine. We were one of the first, in fact, right, to put in each of the measures, including the stay at home.
Governor J.B. Pritzker of Illinois, and we wish you the very best. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judy.
The number of coronavirus cases in the Middle East has risen to nearly 60,000, double the amount only a week ago. Special correspondent Jane Ferguson reports from Beirut on how an already fragile healthcare systems are bracing themselves against the pandemic.
Another victim of the coronavirus limps out of his apartment building. Lebanese Red Cross volunteers have dressed him in protective clothing to keep the disease from spreading. His elderly mother is not allowed to go with him. That's my son. My son, she tells us. They took him to the hospital before and let him go again. Maybe they know something I don't know. It's very likely she's carrying the virus. We cannot stay and hear her story or offer any comfort. She is left behind in the street, watching, helpless. The Lebanese Red Cross is the only option for people here when they need an ambulance. The country's healthcare system doesn't provide the service. These first responders are more vital now than ever.
Most of our volunteers are recruited because they genuinely believe in this mission and they believe in the principles that are part of the international movement of the Red Cross and Red Crescent. These being humanity, impartiality, independence, neutrality, and voluntary service.
Circling the skies above Beirut, soldiers in Lebanese army helicopters warn people by loudspeaker to stay indoors. Lebanon reacted to the pandemic quickly, beginning a phased shutdown 5 weeks ago. Now there is a nightly curfew, and during the day, people are only really allowed out to buy food or medicine. The country's strict early lockdown was in reaction to the certainty that Lebanon's healthcare system would not cope with a pandemic. Decades of corruption and a financial crisis that just bankrupted the government have left the authorities here with little choice but to try preventing the spread of the disease as much as possible.
And maybe it will have an impact on the flow and the curve of the epidemic in Lebanon. It will help us certainly to flatten a little bit the curve. We don't know exactly now at this present situation how much we will flatten the curve, but it helped us.
Dr. Georges Ghanem is the head doctor at the Lebanese American University Hospital. His colleagues are racing to prepare for an expected spike of cases this week, according to medical forecasts. They have sent other patients home and canceled elective surgeries. The hope here is that the lockdown will help save lives where hospitals can't.
Across the Middle East, hospitals like this are bracing for an onslaught of patients of COVID-19. They know their healthcare systems will not be able to cope, and so they are trying to scramble as quickly as they can.
In Jordan, the lockdown was the strictest seen in the region. All cars have been banned from the roads, with military checkpoints to reinforce the new rules. For the first few days, they blocked anyone from leaving their homes, even for food, threatening up to a year in jail for anyone caught in the streets. Now people are allowed out, only on foot, to buy groceries. But not every country in the Middle East is capable of this. For the 27 million people living in war-ravaged Yemen, survival has been a daily struggle for years. With no testing, there is no realistic way of knowing if the country has any coronavirus cases or how widespread it is. Syria is another country with a healthcare system ravaged by war and millions displaced from their homes. Bashar al-Assad's government says there has been just one death so far linked to COVID-19. The country's years-long diplomatic isolation may be helping it right now. But aid agencies have been struggling to deal with a humanitarian disaster in the northeast province of Idlib for months, where millions fleeing the Assad army's advance are cramped into camps. It's not known if the virus has a presence there, but refugees in the camps know the living conditions mean it would surely spread quickly.
If all these big countries have failed in confronting the disease, what can we do against it?
What can we do where powerful countries have failed?
Egypt's ancient pyramids lit up with social distancing messages on Tuesday night. Cairo is a city of 20 million people and known for its nightlife, but it's been under nighttime curfew for over a week.
This is a disease. It's no joke. People must stay at home and not leave their homes after curfew hours.
Egypt's dictatorship expelled a British journalist for reporting that the number of cases in the country is likely much higher than the official figures. In Iraq, the religious site of Karbala, one of the most sacred in Shia Islam, has been closed and disinfected. But it may be too late to prevent the spread. The country's struggling healthcare system is ill-equipped to deal with the pandemic. Israel's health minister, Yaakov Litzman, has tested positive for COVID-19. He has been in close contact in recent weeks with embattled Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Both are now in quarantine. The country has over 6,000 known cases so far, and the military has been brought in to help enforce a strict lockdown. Mickey Rosenfeld is the spokesman for Israel's police.
Our units are making sure that people are at home, are only at a maximum radius of 100 meters from any given area at any one given time.
Ancient religious sites in Jerusalem, like the Western Wall and Church of the Holy Sepulchre, have been disinfected, while testing has been ramped up, with drive-through tests now available. Yet, the virus is ravaging ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities.
It's very hard for us, because normally here in this city, we're always together, and we like the community.
For the most part, people in the Middle East are taking the threat posed by COVID-19 seriously and complying with social distancing. Mosques, synagogues, and churches are all closed. Watching the virus ravage advanced and well-equipped healthcare systems in the West, many here know their only hope is the prevention of the spread, rather than relying on overstretched or underfunded hospitals.
We in the Middle East are used to live in a crisis mode. This is not the case of the Western country. They are in a more comfort zone where everything is assured and everything is here by the government.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jane Ferguson in Beirut, Lebanon.
Lots of late-breaking political news tonight, including new questions over Wisconsin's planned elections tomorrow. Our Lisa Desjardins has the latest.
That's right. These are uncertain times in so many ways. To help us understand the effect on politics and election politics, of course, it's time for Politics Monday. That means we're joined by the Cook Political Report, Amy Walter, also host of Public Radio's Politics with Amy Walter, and Tamara Keith of NPR Politics Podcast. Ladies, I see your bookshelves and typewriters, and I see you with my own. First question has got to be about Wisconsin, the on-again, off-again election. Amy, let me start with you. What can we take from this about the rest of this very election year?
That's right. Lisa, what makes Wisconsin very unique is that it is one of the very few states to still be holding a primary here in the middle of a pandemic. So many states, 15 other states, have postponed their primaries. What's different about Wisconsin, though, is it's not just a presidential primary. It's also a municipal and statewide election day. It's actually in the law that Wisconsin has elections on this Tuesday in April. And so in order to change the law, it needs to go through the legislative process. Well, guess what? There's a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature. And as you probably know, Wisconsin has had long history of fights between the legislature and the governor. And in this case, they could not agree on how to hold the election safely. And the governor this morning said, well, fine, we're just not going to have an election then. I'm closing down all in-person voting. The legislature said, we don't think so. We're going to appeal this. And the courts came out just very recently, within the last few minutes, to say, no, the election will go on. So there will be polling places open, though very few, Lisa. In a city, in the city of Milwaukee, there are only five polling places that are open to handle this. Now, they've had a lot of vote by mail. There are a lot of ballots that have already gone out, but there's still a tremendous amount of confusion for voters in Wisconsin. Just very quickly, I think we need to understand what this is going to tell us if anything, for what this could mean for November. The first is Wisconsin is going to be potentially a preview of what other states, especially states with divided legislatures or a governor of one party and the legislature of another, might be dealing with when having to try to change voting laws very quickly. Democrats want to see more voting by mail. Republicans say that's rife with fraud. And the second is in a state like Wisconsin, where vote by mail is already very infrequent, only 5% of voters turned in their ballots by mail in 2016, trying to get to 100% vote by mail, even if it's in November, is going to be structurally very challenging for the clerks and all the folks who are responsible for putting these elections together.
Of course, the man who hopes to be the Democratic nominee. Look at some pictures really quickly. Skype. He's done some campaigning. There you see him shelf, but also trying to bring people in chats. This is not the stuff of electrifying. But also tonight, Tam, he did have President Trump. What do you make of that phone call and what the former vice president is trying to do right now?
The former vice president is attempting to continue to stay in the picture, to stay relevant. He is doing a lot of work on coronavirus-related issues. And this call with the president, it's one of those things that sort of grew out of a back and forth on cable between aides to the president and then aides to the vice president and to Vice President, former Vice President Biden, and ultimately ended up with this approximately 15-minute call. Apparently, according to the president, they agreed not to discuss the substance of their conversation with the broader public. But President Trump said it was very pleasant. The Biden campaign said that Biden offered some suggestions. President Trump seems very happy with the phone call. I mean, it's kind of this odd thing, but you know, this is not a normal campaign, and this is not a normal time at all. One thing that I would say more broadly about the state of play right now is that both Biden and Trump are acting like they are the nominees. Obviously, President Trump is the presumptive nominee and running for re-election, but the Trump campaign has aimed all of its fire now at Vice President, former Vice President Biden, and Biden is entirely focused on Trump and coronavirus.
Just 1 minute left, I'm sorry to say. Quickly, Tam, what do you make of the president firing the Inspector General of the intelligence community, Michael Atkinson, politically there or upside? And Amy, what do you make of how the president's operating now? Tam, quickly.
Yeah, you know, this is the latest in a long line of people who have been connected with the impeachment who have been pushed out by President Trump or otherwise fired. This happened very late at night. The news broke late at night on Friday. Didn't even make a lot of front pages on Saturday, and in some ways, rightfully so, but because the coronavirus is so dominant and people were dying over the weekend. But this is certainly just a pattern of President Trump taking it out on people who he thinks have wronged him.
Amy?
Absolutely. When the president's style has not changed at all, whether we're in the middle of the crisis or in the middle of just what was before COVID-19, a normal day, this is what the election is going to be about in November. You can see the Biden campaign already setting up this contrast with the president. One is, he will say of the president, it's too chaotic. It's too much focused on getting back at his enemies. Joe Biden is going to say, I'm a steadier hand, and there we go.
I think you are both steady hands, regardless, and I'll see you again next week. Walter, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Lisa, Amy, and Tam. And tonight online, a special episode of our podcast where we hear about how people in all kinds of situations are handling the overwhelming feeling of isolation that this coronavirus crisis has brought. You can find that episode at pbs.org/newshour or on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.